Rob mentioned that, cited Richard Danzig, talked about a preventive strategy. Dennis Ross and myself have spent most of the last year writing a book. And a term that we use in the book is engagement without illusions. Sometimes you engage not because you always think you're going to succeed, but because you want to avert a slide to radicalization. And I think that that could also be seen here. This doesn't mean to be pessimistic. It doesn't mean to be fatalistic, because things change and things can be fluid, and therefore there's hope. But I think if engagement is only framed as where will you guarantee a success, or where will you strike a well with a lot of water, it seems to me that that might not be the only definition of engagement. It might be you engage because you believe there's risks of action, but there's risks of inaction, and that you see that you can't take this issue and put it on a shelf for 20 years and believe it's going to come out the same way as it is today. But you fear inaction discredits the moderates and emboldens the radicals who are waiting to pounce and to say, see, you got nothing, to their own countrymen. So therefore, I think it's complex. Now, there are a lot of issues, and by me focusing on the Arab-Israeli issue is not a way of to discount democratization. Rob gave an excellent list, the issues of succession and Egypt, Saudi Arabia. There's a whole lot of issues that are going to come up in the Middle East, apart from the Gulf and the Arab-Israeli, but I've been asked to focus on this. Now, it's clear that given the severe recession that is everyone says is that we're in or ahead of us, how you like it, the presidential attention is going to be diffused. But I would argue that's not the only way of looking at an issue, that if the President of the United States isn't spending full time being a desk officer on an issue, that means his administration won't engage on it. I think in the Arab-Israel issue, you have two things. One is it has a symbolic first-tier value because he has made this issue of engagement and trying to contrast himself with the Bush administration so central to his presidency that this will have symbolic value. I think the day he came back from Ramallah and Jerusalem, he appeared on Meet the Press. I think it was one of the first shows that Tom Brokaw did after Tim Russert suddenly died. And he said, I'm here to announce that on the first day of my presidency, I will have a special envoy to deal with the Arab-Israeli issue. He's committed to this publicly, and privately he is in small groups, not at big rallies of 100,000 people at a stadium. We keep hearing this from dozens and dozens of people, that he says, this is an issue, I'm not going to wait till the end of my administration to tackle this issue. I think personally, I think it's a false dichotomy to say if he can't personally be a desk officer on an issue, therefore it won't have no importance. I don't think it'll work that way. There's going to have to be some sort of a ripening on any given issue that you could hand off to people that are under you that don't require the president's full-time attention. There might be timed interventions, but there's no need. I mean, I don't think anyone believes, for example, that you could pick up where you left off with Camp David and Taba in the year 2000 and 2001. So I don't think that's the model at all. Now, where do I see this engagement, to be specific? I think here it will depend a lot what is the new composition of the new Israeli government. Israel goes to the polls on February the 10th. And I think that will have an impact on how an Obama administration looks at the Arab-Israeli question. If I have time, I could go into some depth or respond to questions on those elections. But I think the key element here is that on the Syria track, if Israel and Syria want to talk to each other as they did in Turkey, I see an Obama administration as wanting to facilitate that. And I see Turkey and Sarkozy and their role as kind of bridges until that moment comes. Now, ironically, it might not be the people you think are the ones in Israel who are the ones proposing it. Actually, it was Bibi Netanyahu who was the biggest supporter of a Syria track when he sent cosmetics magnate Ronald Lauder to try to work it out, and it was Ariel Sharon who blocked it. And Tzipi Livni has been critical of Ehud Olmert for pursuing these talks, the indirect talks in Turkey. So I think, it's unclear if it could break down during kind of predictable lines. But I see the approach to be somewhat like Henry Kissinger did with the Egyptians in the 1970s. Namely, Kissinger was very skillful in prying Egypt away from the Soviet orbit. Can an Obama administration do anything comparable with a willing Israeli government in trying to pry Syria away from the Iranian orbit? What will it take? No one's going to jump into a pool that has no water. That will require, a discussion. I'm not here predicting successes in anything, but I tend to think, given what Obama said on the record, I think he will want to test that channel, especially if an Israeli government wants to test that channel, as it has in 2008. Let me quickly transition to the Palestinian issue. I think this question of how do you salvage a two-state solution is part of the issue, and I think it's also how do you avert a Hamas takeover of the West Bank. Remember what I said at the start, the issue of engagement without illusions of trying to avert a slide to radicalization. To me, I think this is key, and I think any Obama administration is going to want to identify, are there converging interests here? And are there converging interests between an Israel that sees Hamas as a terrorist organization despite a ceasefire in Gaza, and a convergence with a Palestinian Authority that fears Hamas wanting to take the PA back to the 12th century? I see this as an AHA, an anti-Hamas alliance, essentially, and that these converging interests are going to be what drives U.S. policy. Again, maybe not to a comprehensive peace, maybe something less than that. There are different options. I don't want to say definitively one way or the other, but I think the fear of Hamas's ascendance is going to be critical in this whole thing. And what also might be interesting, and this may be a little counterintuitive to some people, I tend to think that this converging interest may create a situation where a PA authority, for its own reasons, because it fears being overrun by Hamas, and that it wants to focus on institutions, will not necessarily be so insistent or wanting the Israeli army to pull out so fast, because they want to build up those institutions. Now, what's blocking that scenario? What blocks that scenario, it seems to me, is being able to credibly tell the Palestinians, we're going to have to wait for a state because we're not ready. We don't have the institutions. We don't have the security forces. We'll be overrun by Hamas. It's not so bad that Israel stays for a while. But, and here's the caveat, but there has to be greater clarity, I think, on the settlements issue. And I think that this issue for the top leadership of the PA has risen as opposed to being diminished. And I think it's a more differentiated view of settlements than public would see it as. I think that their sense of things is more, I could tell my public to wait, but I can't tell my public to wait for a state while the other side is building. Now, if there was an understanding, a delineation on where this Palestinian state is going to be, where is going to be Israel, some of you have heard me say before about 200 out of 268,000 settlers in the West Bank live in less than 5% of the land, largely contiguous to the old pre-67 boundary. In my view, that we're now at the point that the differences between the sides are minuscule. And that's why I think Jimmy Carter is so wrong, because he thinks Israel has a land lust. And I don't think they have a land lust. I think they just don't want to get bombed with Qassam rockets. And if they felt that for land they could get peace as opposed to for land they would get Qassams, I think they'd have a different view. So it could be, at a time that you want to bolster the moderates, there may be an advantage to delineate where this state is going to be. If Israel builds a skyscraper in somewhere that's going to be Israel, that's fine. If the Palestinians build it on their side, that's fine. But there's needless finger pointing here, because basically the differences are minuscule. So it seems to me that this is something that you might want to look at, where there could be a convergence, that the moderates could say they achieved something, and yet they don't want the Israeli army to leave so quickly. So I think this may seem a little counterintuitive, but I think that this is something worth exploring. But there's the short-term issues. Rob touched on some important short-term issues when he that have long-term historic impact, the incitement issue of the school books, things like that, about Israel's moral legitimacy in the region. And I think for the Palestinian side, it's seeing daily life get better. The people are so jaded, they don't believe in the enterprise of peacemaking. You know, I tell the joke that even the settlers didn't want to waste a demonstration in demonstrating against the Olmert government because they didn't think this would get anywhere. So even the other elements who are not supportive of the peace have not come out because there's a kind of otherworldly quality to this whole enterprise. Therefore, for you to recreate the centers in both Palestinian and Israeli society, it seems to me people need to see the change. They don't want to hear the change. They have to see it through economic improvements for Palestinians, and we can get into that if you want, or on the Israeli side, that they believe they're really being accepted and integrated in the region, and they're there by right and not just because they're strong. So that, I think, is another issue. Of course, you know, the $64,000 question is, well, what are you going to do with Gaza? How does that fit in? And here, I think we're going to be, could be getting to a crossroads. I don't see any big sense that these dialogue in Cairo is going to go anywhere. It's not for lack of the Egyptian effort for trying, but it's because they seem to be going their own way. Now, the Arab states could do something that could make a difference, but I fear to say, without insulting anyone here, that when all is said and done, more is said than done. And that what happens is people will blame all sides. They'll use very vague language, you know, that will not pin the success, you know, the failure on Hamas. And therefore, these things kind of just go with their own inertia. And with their own inertia, they seem to be going in separate ways. And it could be if the Arab states don't blame Hamas. And look, they don't always blame Iran. Even though when you talk to all these Arab leaders, they all are frightful of Iran and are very expressive privately. They don't do that publicly. Why should they do this publicly? So I don't think there's a high probability here. But that could create its pressures on people saying, well, maybe, you know, that the PA just wants Hamas to go its own way. And then people will ask questions about the 150,000 people who are getting salaries in Gaza from the PA at Israel's understanding, because they didn't want to turn these Gazans against the PA. In the latest polls, it should be said, in JMCC, and risk of ruining your day, because to hear good news about the Middle East is to ruin everyone's day. They're so conditioned to hear bad news. It's fascinating in these polls that even in Gaza, that there's a lot of support for Salam Fayyad's government and what he's doing economically to improve the lives of the Palestinians. If the paradigm was West Bank, West Berlin, Gaza, East Berlin, two ideological distinct places that are geographically distinct, if you believe the polls, these polls show that people say, hey, things are getting better in the West Bank. Now, are they getting better enough? Of course not. It's never enough. But you saw a million tourists this year in Bethlehem. You've seen unemployment drop to its lowest level in 8 years. You've seen the start of foreign investment. You've seen now Israel and the PA security forces working together in Jenin, Nablus, and now Israel approved 550 Palestinians in Hebron. So after 8 years of the Israeli and Palestinian security establishments being apart, although people say they never were fully apart, and there was some local coordination, that coordination seems to grow. Again, does that mean you have peace tomorrow? No. But given this converging interest against a common threat, it might not be a bad basis to build on. I don't want to get into the Iranian issue. I leave that to Patrick, but Patrick was correct in his talk about the anxieties in Israel, about things unrelated to Palestinians, unrelated to Syria, related to the issue of Iran, and whether engagement will come at their expense. And yes, this might be the fear of some of the Gulf states and as well, since President-elect Obama loves basketball. I think it's fair to say that while there could be an engagement without illusions on the Iranian track, and I think that's where it's definitely going, it seems to me that it's got to be like, you got to be mindful of the basketball metaphor. You don't want one side to run out the clock as you're talking because they're trying to complete their nuclear program. So it's going to have to be a balancing act with economic pressure. But that is something, just focusing on the Israel piece of this, there will be anxieties here, and that will test the U.S.-Israel relationship. I saw for the first time the first discordant note today emerge from Israel about Obama from Foreign Minister Livni saying that Israel is against such engagement, which I was surprised that she would say that in public. But she's also in an election campaign for February 10th. But the anxieties are real. That part of it is real. It's not political. So where do we go? I won't get into the internal Israel horse race now because I don't want to take up time. I'll just end on something about what I say is there an Obama factor in the elections? In other words, does this election create a new, a new variable? And I think it does. I think there's no doubt that Foreign Minister Livni is going to cite, the peace process is a central concern of Obama as a way to say, if you want good close ties with the United States for the next 4 years, vote for me or else you're going to have friction. And she might, because of the nature of these election campaigns, is everyone dramatizes the other side, the direness of the other side. So that'll probably get dramatized, I think, in the months ahead. And then I think on the other end, I keep thinking of 1977. And what's the flip side danger? And the flip side danger, and I don't think you will see it with President-elect Obama, because I don't think he is Jimmy Carter in a variety of ways. I don't think that's a fair comparison. But I do think that the friction between Carter and Rabin in the final months of the Rabin premiership, and the first 3 or 4 months, by the way, it didn't take a long time, of the Carter presidency led to Begin being elected. And people forget that, I think. I don't want to overstate it. There were a lot of factors at work here, kind of pent-up feeling over the Yom Kippur War of 73 that were finally found its expression 29 years, ending labor rule, the division of the labor party into two separate parties. There were a lot of factors. I don't want to make it sound this was the factor, but I think it was a factor that people felt that there was a hostility, and therefore they had to move to the right to counter that. And I don't believe that's going to happen here because I think his tone in this campaign and everything he has said about the importance of U.S.-Israel relations has been conciliatory and has talked about the need to strengthen those relations. But if people say, is there an Obama factor, I think it could cut for Livni in a certain way. But if there are some careless remarks by people who might not be the president and might not even have a position, but people who people think are close who are not, those things will be used, I think, by the Likud as a way to say, oh, this is what we're going to face. We got to elect somebody who could counter that slide. So I do think that that's something to look out for, even if something not said by him or any office holder or even someone close to him. But it could be used in a campaign. Who's ahead, the pluses and minuses of Livni and Netanyahu and Barack, I'll save that for the Q&A in order not to take up time. Thank you all very much.